First of all, I want to say thanks to the ASHS for the opportunity to be here and for waiving the registration fee. The first slide just shows some of the co-authors on this paper. I'm going to go back over some of the ground that a couple of the speakers have covered already, but I thought what I could probably add to the session that other people wouldn't talk about was the human angle in all of this. So I'm going to talk about who it is that we think will be living with HLB in the future. And I think the human angle in all of this is really important. So Manjul asked us to give a quick update on the situation in each of our states, and Ed's already covered a little bit of this for California, but here's a quick overview of what's happening. We just passed 1,500 trees officially confirmed, detected and removed last week. We're at about 1,522. We're finding infected trees in the LA basin at the rate of about 20 to 30 a week at the moment, with the official detection and removal eradication program. Just to say a little bit about that, the growers in 2012, when they saw what was happening in Florida, they approached the state legislature to set up an assessment under state law. The bill was passed, AB 281 was passed in 2012, and the growers, that gives the growers the legal authority to tax themselves and raise money specifically to fight HLB. The annual assessment at the moment is about $15 to $18 million a year. It depends a bit on the crop size. The state has been putting in about $10 million of general funds as well, and together with federal money that comes through the Citrus Health Response Plan, the overall budget for fighting HLB in California at the moment is about $40 million a year. It's going to go down a little bit next year because the state has reduced its input but has established a full-time citrus program. At the moment during the summer when the survey teams are out looking for HLB, if we have a medfly outbreak, which we do every year, then the people who are looking for HLB get pulled off of looking for HLB to go and deal with the medfly outbreak. But in the future, because there's now a ring-fenced citrus program, although there's less money, the people who are in the citrus program won't be taken away to do other things during the summer. So that's the situation we're in. There's the red circles are on the right-hand plot show where the HLB quarantines are, so mainly in Orange and LA counties, and it's a little bit of an outbreak in Riverside County. And the blow up on the left-hand side just shows those in more detail. But as I say, all of the trees that have been detected so far are in private backyards. There are no known infected trees in commercial citrus. We expect that situation will change this year because of the proximity to some of the known infections in LA and Riverside and Anaheim. California is a completely fresh, or almost a completely fresh, fruit market. And in response to the situation that we saw in Florida, where it was known that transport provides a dissemination pathway for ACP, we did some background science work and submitted a white paper to the grower committee who manages the spread of the disease, and they encouraged CDFA to pass some new regulations. So in January of 2018, and state interior quarantines came into effect that make use of the topography to help reduce the spread of ACP between different growing areas. So there are seven ACP quarantine areas in the state, and growers have to use mitigations to move citrus from one to another. Fresh fruit markets, so fruits generally picked direct into 900-pound field bins, and then those are loaded about 40 to a truck and driven around the state to be cleaned and packed. And you can see on the diagram on the left, there's a lot of fruit moving between different areas. The growers in one area don't necessarily pack in that area. They maybe have a deal with a packing house somewhere else. A lot of fruit goes out to Ventura, where there is a sizable lemon industry there on the coast, but there's a packing facilities that are way beyond the capacity that the lemon industry needs for its own use. But a lot of fruit goes out to the coast to be packed so that it can go down to Long Beach or to LA to go out and leave the country. But you can see there's fruit moving around from one zone to another all over the state, and so the regulations that we encourage the industry to impose to cover the trucks and to impose pre-harvest sprays or to field clean the fruit have done a lot to reduce the movement of the vector around the state, and particularly since we introduced those legislations detections in the Central Valley, where the bulk of the industry is based, have gone down to almost zero. There has been one sizable outbreak in the Central Valley. That was 3 years ago, when psyllid numbers were pretty high. There was some populations established in the city of Bakersfield, and the program spent about between $3.5 and $6 million. Figures are a little bit hard to estimate, eradicating that outbreak. And because they eradicated that outbreak, the psyllid population wasn't able to establish in the Central Valley. Central Valley is still in eradication mode. So how is it managed? The typical pillars that HLB management is based on that have been around since early work by Beauvais and others. So there's aggressive vector control where possible, not in the urban areas, but everywhere else. There are various quarantine areas, both for ACP and HLB, with additional mitigations to allow fruit to be moved. And then there's a fairly large-scale biocontrol program, release of tamarixia. And I think they've released something like 11 million individual wasps over the lifetime of the program so far. That doesn't in itself do much to reduce the spread of the vector or the disease in a particular area, but it helps to suppress it a little bit in the urban area. It gives us a tool that we can give to householders to help them to encourage to be part of the program, and it's extremely valuable from a political perspective because the existence of the biocontrol program allows the program to continue to operate under emergency status that allows it to be exempt from some oversight in terms of pesticide use for suppression of the vectors. So without the biocontrol program, if that wasn't there as a political tool, the rest of the program would be in a lot of trouble. So tree removal in the urban area. We know we're not really finding all of the trees. We know that qPCR is ineffective from us, not because the test itself has poor sensitivity or specificity, but because it's hard to find the bacterium when it's at low titer in the tree. We've done a lot of work looking at where the infected trees are in relation to each other in the urban environment, trying to come up with regulations that the control program can use to say, if we find one infected tree, then the probability that other trees in the yard are infected is X, and so therefore they can declare a whole yard as being exposed and then use the abatement legislation to clear the whole yard. And we're working towards something like that at the moment. But you can understand that we have to go very slowly in terms of not triggering a negative response in the public. In general, people are on board with the idea that the trees aren't going to recover in those urban environments, and so therefore it's better in the long term to get them out. There's a public relations company that handles all of that side of things for the program, and the program spends about $1 million a year on that public relations subcontract to encourage the public to come along with the industry. The industry is established on certified, so some horticulture at last. The industry is established on certified material, so 100% commercial acreage is planted from certified material. The clonal protection program at UC Riverside is a big part of that. And this photograph in the lower right is a typical kind of undercover nursery under these large air-inflated domes. And in this case, the end door was open when we were there to take the photograph because they were moving some material out of the dome that year. That one's actually in Ventura County. The nursery industry has three quarantine areas. It operates under a three quarantine area system, so slightly different from the fruit production industry. Okay, so that's a quick background of what's happening in California. Now to the people and the future. So this is a kind of recap on some of the stuff that Ed talked about. I'm going to talk a little bit about Florida, and then I'm going to talk a little bit more about California. So here's the take-home message if I don't get to the end of the talk before Manjul stands up and pulls me off. Who's going to be living with HLB in the future? Well, here are the four characteristics that I think growers need to have in order to be in citrus production in the future. You need to be rich, you need to be determined, you need to be adaptable, and you need to be lucky. Okay, and I'm going to talk a little bit about why that is. So here's the historical timeline for citrus production in Florida, and I'm going to talk a little bit about work that Tim Gottwald and Errol Taylor presented at the recent international conference. So this is just a blow-up of the same figure again, and you can see the decline in the last couple of decades at the end there.
So why does the production curve look like that? Well, in that period from the 80s through to the mid-90s, there were significant freezes. In that period there were three significant hurricanes, and that's also the period when citrus canker hit the industry in Florida, and then that bit at the end, that's when HLB has been present. Okay, so Tim and Errol put all of that together and made a fairly standard econometric type model with all of these different factors in it. So here's the equation for the model, and tested to see, with all of those different factors present in the model, which ones came out to be significant. And not surprisingly, HLB and Bering Acres had a big impact, but some of the hurricanes did as well, and the freezes less so. And here you can see just for the industry overall, the actual data, and the blue line is the fitted model. And you can see, notwithstanding the recent uptick this year, Ed, that the models and the actual data look like a pretty poor prognosis for Florida. Well, clearly, both the extrapolation from the real data and the projection from the model are overly gloomy. But still, I think, in spite of Ed's optimism, the situation doesn't look tremendous for Florida. I mean, I think that would be a consensus. Except, Except, there's this guy. And I was flicking through citrus industry news back earlier in the year and came across this article. And this is Michel Salin, who is a vertically integrated fruit grower in the Indian River area of Florida. And back in March or April, Citrus Industry published this article saying that his company, IMG, had just bought 4,000 acres of grapefruit in the Indian River area. And I was absolutely fascinated by this piece of news. I thought, huh, why? Okay, so I visit Fort Pierce maybe four times a year to work with various people. So one time when I was over there after that, I asked Doug Burnick from the Indian River Citrus League if they could arrange for me to meet Michelle so I could interview him. And they said, yeah, absolutely, you should go and talk to him. He's an interesting guy. So I emailed him, and I went to see him in Vero Beach at the packing house. And he's a lovely guy, French guy. And he said, we sat down across the conference table, and I said, so? And he said, so? And then he kind of looked at me and he said, so, you want to know why this crazy French guy has just bought 4,000 acres of grapefruit? And I kind of looked at my shoes and said, well, yeah, actually, that is what I want to know. And I was expecting him to say something about economics or something like that. But the story was actually a little bit more interesting. So here's the price of oranges and according to USDA statistics. And at this point, I'm going to bring in another colleague of mine, Bruce Babcock, who's an economist at UC Riverside, and talk a little bit about the work he does. And the key here is that we have to think about the value of citrus, okay? And so Bruce is interested in the question, what's the value of citrus? And it doesn't have necessarily anything to do with the price of oranges. And it doesn't have anything to do with the economic impact figures that you'll see people use to talk about citrus. Okay, so for Michelle, what's the value of citrus? And it turns out that it has more to do with this kind of thing that I've tried to capture by using these lovely old citrus labels, one from Florida and one from California. Point here is that things that don't cost anything can still have a value. Okay, Facebook is a paradigm example. Free at the point of use, and yet it's the value of Facebook on the stock is several $1 billion. So free things can have a value. That's one thing. And then the annual economic impact figures that you'll see for citrus industries. So Bruce recently for the industry just came up with a figure of $7.2 billion of economic impact for California citrus. That doesn't have much to do with the value of the citrus industry to the individual growers. Why did Michel Salim just buy 4,000 acres of grapefruit in the Indian River? Here's what he told me. Because when they came from France to be part of the citrus industry a long time ago, they quickly learned that they came at a period when the winters were going to be pretty bad. They lost a lot of money early on, and he decided that it wasn't a good idea to be 100% a citrus grower, so they diversified. But still, he feels the Indian River community has done a lot for him and his family, and he wants that tradition to continue. Because he learned the lesson early that he needed to diversify, he now has enough money so that he can afford to keep his bit of the citrus industry going. And he wants there to be citrus in the Indian River when the answers are found by the science, so that the industry can regrow from something. And it doesn't have anything to do with him cashing in on being the last man standing. He's losing money to do this, but he wants there to be an industry in the future. So we have to factor that into thinking about who's going to be in production in the future, because the value of the citrus industry to Michel Salin has more to do with the tradition than it does with the price of citrus or the value of juice. So then if we come to look at how an economist would view something like that traditionally, we have this supply-demand curve, and of course economists do things backwards. So if you think about the market price going up and down like a piston on the vertical axis, it pushes the quantity supplied in and out on the horizontal. Okay, so they do things backwards from the way that we normally do things in science. So we have a demand curve sloping from the top left to the bottom right, and we can also think in terms of that being the willingness to pay on the consumer's part for what they'll pay for an orange. And then there's a supply curve that rises from left to right. And at the point where they meet, that's where the market's supposed to clear. In classical economics, that's where your supply and demand are balanced, and that's where the market will operate. So the bit of the curve that's above the supply curve and below the demand curve, under the market price, that's the producer's value of citrus. That's the value in economic terms that they get from producing HLB-free citrus, okay, in a world without HLB. And the bit of the supply that's under the supply curve but above the market price, that's the consumer's benefit from HLB citrus. So that's what they get. If they were willing to, they'd be willing to pay more, but the market price is lower, so the bit between what they're willing to pay and the price they pay is the value you get from citrus. Okay, if you would pay more for an orange than what you have to pay, then there's value in the orange for you, so you buy it, essentially. And you can see then that the market price basically splits all of the available benefit between the producers and the consumers. The higher the price, the more of the benefit the producer gets. The lower the price, the more of the benefit the consumer gets. But in order for there to be any benefit to split between consumers and growers, there have to be some growers who are willing to produce a supply curve that under the conditions that will obtain under HLB. And that supply curve is an aggregate of thousands and thousands of individual growers who have individual production situations, and some of whom are people like Michel Salin, who's going to be in business for reasons that you couldn't capture in any way except by interviewing him and asking him why he bought 4,000 acres of Indian River grapefruit last year or earlier this year. And by the way, he told me that they had waited for years to be able to make that purchase, but there hadn't been a grove up until then that was still in a condition where they felt it was a good investment for them. In other words, that was the first sizable area of production left that they felt they would be able to buy and keep it in a state where they would be able to continue to grow it. So maybe some of the stuff that Jude was talking about in terms of micronutrients is important there. Okay, we're closing in on the end of the talk here. I want to talk a little bit about the comment I made about being lucky, and here's a picture of the ACP dynamics in three of the many citrus health management areas in Florida. And I just picked these three for an illustrative example. So the blue line is the Corkscrew citrus health management area, and you can see they've done a pretty good job of keeping ACP numbers down across the health management area. So if you happen to be in that citrus health management area, you're lucky. You're doing your job, and apparently your neighbours are too, and that's the key thing. If you're in the grey one, which is the Seminole East Orange Chima, They're not doing so well there. So if you happen to be there, I'm sorry. Some of your neighbours probably aren't doing their job, and you're stuck with what they think of as an adequate ACP population. So this problem isn't just to do with where you are. It's got to do with where your neighbours are. And so basically, it's a public goods problem. And there's an expression by the economist Fred Hirsch in the 70s of what a public goods problem is. So I thought, just to wrap up, somewhat of a tongue-in-cheek exercise here, I thought I would take the four factors that I think are important and build a little risk assessment model in the software that we use for doing that kind of thing, and then kind of ascribe values to it. So what comes out of doing an exercise like this is what I think is the balance between those four things. And I didn't know what I thought the balance between those four things was. And it turns out that I think that personality matters much more than circumstances, apparently a weighting of 2-1. And I think that it's much more important to be lucky than rich. Okay. Which you really can't do much about, although the golfers say that you make your own luck. Okay. If you're having trouble envisioning how that works, I've made a kind of picture of it here, which I'm going to... So we've got two two-dimensional plots happening simultaneously. So I've taken the personality factors on the left and the circumstance factors on the right. So if you want to be as adaptable as Matt Watney from The Martian and as determined as John Wick, okay? You don't want to be, and so that puts you in the top right-hand corner there. And somewhere between Eeyore the donkey and John Wick, you maybe have Serena Williams in terms of determination. And somewhere between a kakapo, which is a ground living parrot that's in danger of being extinct because its response to changes in circumstances is to breed less. Okay, so if you lack adaptation as badly as a kakapo and you're as determined as Eeyore, you're probably toast. Okay, you might get away with things if you're as determined as Serena Williams and as adaptable as Sean Doolittle. Sean Doolittle is a closing pitcher now, pitches for the Nationals in Washington. He was drafted as a first baseman, and that wasn't working out, so he changed. While he was playing with the Athletics to become a closing pitcher. So you might show that level of adaptation, nothing like the guy who survived being left on Mars all on his own. Okay, but so you want to be on the top right-hand corner. So if you want to remember surviving traits, think John Wick and Matt Watney. Okay, that'll get you there in terms of personality. What about in terms of being rich and lucky? You don't want to be Aqualung the Tramp from Jethro Tull. He's not going to survive in terms of rich. Even the Clampets might not get you there, but if you're Jeff Bezos, you've probably got deep enough pockets to survive each other. Okay. How about lucky? Don't be a red shirt from Star Trek. Okay. That's bad news. You can really luck out if you get to be Elizabeth Bennet from Pride and Prejudice. Elizabeth Bennet basically lucked out and got everything she ever wanted. Okay, when she met Mr. Darcy, so she's pretty good. Somewhere in between, you could be Harrison Ford, not Han Solo. Why Harrison Ford? Because Al Pacino turned the part down. And Harrison Ford would never have been Han Solo if that hadn't happened. And there was no way for him to control that either. So, be Jeff Bezos meets Elizabeth Bennet. This is some mashup, okay? And be John Wick meets Matt Watney, and you'll probably be okay with HLB. That's my take home.
Thank you.